Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comments. It's Tuesday, November 21st, 2017. What appears to be classic incoherence on the part of the Trump administration, I think actually is an attempt to obscure a very political and perhaps unconstitutional move. The issues are near and dear to me. They relate to the even playing field of the internet, net neutrality. It allows me to deliver you this podcast without any hurdles. And on the same basis as CNN or the New York Times or anybody else, including Netflix, can deliver content to you. And Ajit Pai, who is the Republican chair of the Federal Communications Commission, is announcing plans that should culminate within a month to dismantle the net neutrality policies that were installed by Barack Obama's FCC chair, Tom Wheeler. And I was a big skeptic of Wheeler's. He came out of a lobbying career for first the wireless phone industry. No, it was first the cable industry, then the wireless phone industry. And when Obama named him, I thought that was going to be the end of net neutrality. But Wheeler surprised us, and he attempted to firm it up. But Ajit Pai is busy dissolving whatever firmness there was, and the plan would give internet providers broad powers to determine what websites and online services customers can see, use, and at what cost. Now, they're saying that this is in the interest of consumers, which, of course, is flat-out bullshit. The decision will be put to a vote at the agency's December 14th meeting in Washington. It's a foregone conclusion because the party that controls the White House has control of 3 out of the 5 seats of the FCC, and that's the picture today. And I encourage you to write letters, well, send emails, it's and make phone calls. But chances are it won't make any difference. The die is cast, the deal has been cut. Ajit Pai wants to prevent the government from micromanaging the internet. He wants to allow corporations to micromanage it by pricing the speed and availability of content that you want to access. And he lies by saying the FCC would simply require internet service providers to be transparent about their practices. Well, this is a major step backward. And, for example, a company like Verizon has been testing the waters by developing proprietary apps and exempting them from the data caps that we all face in our wireless phone bills every month. There's a cap on how much data you can use. And if a certain app doesn't count against that data, you're more likely to use it. And the big dog, Google, issued a statement, the FCC's net neutrality rules are working well for consumers and we're disappointed in the proposal released today. And Tom Wheeler, who I mentioned, is quoted by the Washington Post today, the job of the FCC is to represent the consumer. Tragically, this decision is only for the benefit of the large monopoly services that deliver the internet to the consumer. And what's interesting here is that this move would benefit AT&T should its acquisition of Time Warner be allowed to close, because the telecom giant would have greater power to flex its new content properties from, CNN and the movie archives at Warner Brothers, Time Magazine. Maybe they still have a piece of AOL. I don't even know about that. But when you break it down, the real reason that we are seeing this incoherence in the Trump administration is probably politics. Because the big move announced yesterday is that Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department are moving to block the $84 billion bid for Time Warner by AT&T based on antitrust issues. Now, yesterday, I applauded Ro Khanna, freshman congressman, Democrat from California. He is initiating a new antitrust caucus in the House of Representatives. And I want to be very clear, I oppose the merger of AT&T and Time Warner. Not purely on antitrust basis, because the argument is that this is a vertical integration. It's not swallowing up a competitor and reducing competition in the traditional way. But I'm opposed to virtually all of these big mega mergers because they do reduce consumer choice and give undue influence to individual corporations. But that's not why the Justice Department is moving to do this. It's obvious Trump supports any kind of merger activity. He loves big corporations. He doesn't mind seeing them get bigger. But this is purely, I think, based on his peak at CNN. CNN is a part of the Time Warner combination. It's in the division called Turner Broadcasting. Ted Turner, of course, the mouth of the South, was the guy who created CNN. He also owned TBS and TNT. And those are part of the package in this merger. And the guy to look at here is named Makan Delrahim. I may be pronouncing his name badly. But he was working at the White House for a few months before they parked him at the Justice Department as the top antitrust regulator. Did he have conversations with the Orange Monster while he was working in the White House? Was it dangled, hey, we can park you at Justice because we think you'll support our position on this issue? Well, it turns out that in the past, Delrahim has spoken at length. And he said that since these two companies don't compete against each other, that this should have been a no-brainer. But now he's changed his tune, and instead he is calling for structural remedies. And he has publicly suggested that CNN should be spun off or that AT&T should unload DirecTV. And again, I'm opposed to this mega merger, but AT&T has some solid arguments on its side. The Obama Justice Department didn't move to block the NBC Universal Comcast deal. And the history has been that vertical integration is not seen as an antitrust problem at the Justice Department. So a deal of this sort has not been challenged in the last 40 years. And I think his name is Stevenson, Randall Stevenson, maybe. He is the head of AT&T. And he says, yes, Randall Stevenson. He says that he can't prove that this is Trump using the Justice Department to send a message to CNN, but he strongly suggests that he believes that's the case. And in an analytical piece at the Washington Post today, they go through seven reasons to be suspicious about the motives of the Justice Department blocking this suit, and they begin by citing my comment here that for the FCC to eviscerate net neutrality while the Justice Department is blocking this merger. Simply, you know, these are contradictory moves. And that's why the popular theory is that Trump is doing this. And, of course, he's made public comments opposing this when he was on the campaign trail last year. He slammed CNN on his recent Asian tour. He said he was forced to watch it when he was in the Philippines. And also, this guy Delrahim helped to manage Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court nomination. So he's considered a trustee in the Trump prison system there. And I think that we can't dismiss the likely motivation for this deal. So I find this troubling. These are moves that are hard to undo later on, particularly the dismantling of net neutrality. And chances are AT&T will blink. I don't think they'll give up CNN, but they'll find some way to get this merger approved with by giving up as little as possible, but I think they will have to give up something. Yesterday, there was a meeting in Sochi along the Black Sea between Vladimir Putin and Bashar al-Assad. And Assad, who has survived this over 5-year civil war with a myriad of external proxy forces inserted into the conflict, well, they're not claiming victory, but they're saying that the military operations are wrapping up. And Putin, who hasn't met with Assad for 2 years, gave him a big hug. He said, "We still have a long way to go before we achieve a complete victory over terrorists, but as far as our joint working effort in fighting terrorism on the territory of Syria is concerned, this military operation is indeed wrapping up. I think that now the most important thing, of course, is to move on the political questions, and I note with satisfaction," he's referring to Assad, "your readiness to work with all those who want peace and a solution to the conflict." And in part, Assad said, "We count on the support of Russia to ensure the non-interference of outside players in the political process." But Assad's idea of a political process leaves him in power. And Trump and Rexon Tillerson have sent conflicting signals. Back in April, before the alleged sarin release at Khan Shukun, the Friday before that, both Tillerson and Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, had announced that we were no longer demanding that Assad step down. In recent weeks, Tillerson has reversed course and said that Assad must step down. But what leverage does the U.S. have? And with Trump's efforts, the saber-rattling toward Iran, the support of the Saudi crackdown, and presumably moves that may follow to isolate Iran, to attack Iran, I'm reading rumors that are well-placed of efforts to forge a strong alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel to force a deal on the Palestinians and create a new alliance to confront Iran. So this is really, I think, a pivot point. And I don't think the U.S. has a clue about what we want to see next in Syria, about how any transition could be managed. I mean, who are you going to pluck? You're going to call Hollywood and do a casting call? Yeah, we need a president of Syria. Or maybe the casting couch is over at Langley at CIA headquarters. Nevertheless, it's hard to imagine this turning out well for the United States and our continuing occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even though our footprint is smaller, we are very seriously involved in all of this. There's a great two-part series at Consortium News by our friend Gareth Porter, who has dug into the events of 2007, when Dick Cheney, acting on what we now know was faulty intelligence supplied by Israel, got George W. Bush to authorize U.S. airstrikes in a remote area of Syria at a facility that we claimed included a nuclear reactor. And in this impressive forensic look at this story, Gareth Porter shows that one of the experts named Yusri Abishadi, who worked for the International Atomic Energy Agency staff, he'd been to North Korea 15 times. He knew what a North Korean reactor looked like and the kind of building that it required. And as soon as he saw the aerial photographs of this remote site in Syria, he said, "Look, this building is not tall enough, it's not big enough to house the kind of nuclear reactor that would have been, based on North Korean designs." And there's much more in the series. I encourage you to read it. But what we see is the IAEA was badly compromised, and it served up the results that were demanded by the United States. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And one is Peter Shustak in San Luis Obispo, California here. He told me to feel free to announce his name anytime, and today I'm feeling really free. Thank you, Peter. I appreciate your support. I also want to mention Mark Brodsky, James Quigley, Benny Alto, and Arlene Montemorano. They're all loyal subscribers to this podcast, and I encourage you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, find the menu button, click on it, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You jump to the sign-up page, and it's real easy. The options are there, $5, $10, $20 a month. And our $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book. They are displayed on the sign-up page. We've been sounding the alarm about how the crackdown on so-called fake news has been unevenly applied, especially to progressive news outlets. We've told you about Alternet, the World Socialist website, Consortium News. All have seen huge drop-offs in their Google search referral traffic. And just the other day, Eric Schmidt, who is the boss of Alphabet, the parent company of Google, he was at a security conference in Halifax, Nova Scotia, over the weekend. And Eric Schmidt revealed that his company has specifically targeted the Russian cable channel RT and Sputnik. And get this. This is an Orwellian lie, if I've ever heard one. He said he's strongly not in favor of censorship, but he's very strongly in favor of ranking. And so they are using their algorithms to give a much lower rank to a search result. So let's say you wanted to search for the Putin-Assad meeting. I'm sure RT has covered it. Well, your Google search results on page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 will have every other outlet known to man and woman, but not Sputnik and RT. And maybe when you get to page 9 at the bottom, you'll see them there. Now, just think about your own search habits. How often do you go past the first page of results, much less the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh? And so, there's no secret here. Giving something a lower ranking is a form of censorship. Is it outright blocking access? No. But don't game us on this. Don't try to bullshit us with euphemisms and these kinds of descriptions. It is censorship. And Google knows it, and they're practicing it, and they're using it to improve their access to the U.S. government. In October, Google booted RT from a premium YouTube advertiser program, and then Twitter banned both Sputnik and RT from placing ads on its platform. That'll fix them. And Sputnik and RT editor-in-chief Margarita Simonian has a sense of humor. Good to have Google on record as defying all logic and reason. Facts aren't allowed if they come from RT because Russia. Even if we have Google on congressional record saying they've found no manipulation of their platform or policy violations by RT. And the requirement that RT register as a foreign agent is fascinating to see, because so far I've seen a blistering editorial about it in The Nation magazine and hardly any other complaints. First they came for RT, and I did nothing because I watch NBC. And this is a real affront to the freedom of expression, to our right to hear all voices, even those considered to be propaganda by someone? After all, Trump considers CNN to be propaganda. And we've seen the Russian Duma move to require CNN to register as a foreign agent in Russia. This kind of tit-for-tat only reduces and represses free expression. And Bob Perry over at consortiumnews.com has another great column today where he goes sharply critical of the New York Times for a story published last Saturday. And he dings them for reporting as flat fact that a Kremlin intermediary told the Trump campaign aide George Papadopoulos that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of thousands of emails. Perry writes, the Times apparently feels that this claim no longer needs attribution, even though it apparently comes solely from a 32-year-old guy as part of his plea bargain over lying to the FBI. He continues, beyond the question of trusting an admitted liar like Papadopoulos, his supposed Kremlin contact, Professor Joseph Mifsud, a little-known academic associated with the University of Stirling in Scotland, denied knowing anything about Democratic emails. And then Perry traces the coverage. He notes that Scott Shane in the New York Times wrote, quote, "A crucial detail is still missing. Whether and when Papadopoulos told senior Trump campaign officials about Russia's possession of hacked emails. And it appears the young aide's request for a deeper connection with Russian officials, while he aggressively pursued it, led nowhere." Now, this conflicts with the dramatic headlines that feed the consensus view based on unproven contentions, assertions, and allegations. Scott Shane added, "The court documents describe in detail how Papadopoulos continued to report to senior campaign officials on his efforts to arrange meetings with Russian officials. The documents do not say explicitly whether and to whom he passed on his most explosive discovery that the Russians had what they considered compromising emails on Mr. Trump's opponent." So even while he's admitting to big holes in the story, Scott Shane continues to assert that the Russians had these compromising emails, even after he established that the chain of proof, the chain of evidence, is not complete. And Perry is a fair journalist who says, of course, you know, it could be that the prosecutor's fact, this is based on the plea deal with Papadopoulos, will turn out to be a fact as more evidence emerges. So Perry is more open-minded about the other side of the story than what we ever get from corporate media outlets like the New York Times. And I want to thank a friend on Facebook who dug up a story from The Guardian, March 17th, 2011. Headline reads, "Revealed, U.S. spy operation that manipulates social media." And David Petraeus, who was a hero until he wasn't, he was the guy at CENTCOM who authorized a $2.5 million contract with a U.S. company we've never heard of, $2.76 million, called Entrepid, based in Los Angeles. And they had agreed to develop software that would allow up to 50 U.S.-based controllers to operate false identities from their workstations without fear of being discovered by sophisticated adversaries. These are what critics call sock puppets, false online personalities. And you've heard all about that troll farm in St. Petersburg, the Russian Information Agency, or whatever it's called. Yeah, they were running a troll operation. Was it in fact inspired by this American operation going back 6 years? Well, I don't know, but I think it's a great question. And it was Mad Dog Mattis who succeeded Petraeus, General James Mattis, and he told a military committee that this software supports all activities associated with degrading the enemy narrative, including web engagement and web-based product distribution capabilities. And this is what never gets reported. We have a massive, offensive cyber warfare operation. And what we attribute to Russia could be from our own side, it could be from a third party, and it could be from that guy Trump referred to, the fat guy on his couch in New Jersey. Because we know that you can misattribute an IP address or other tracing information about who actually originated a signal or who received it. Think about that. Well, after 37 years as the maximum leader of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe got the message. What is he, 93 years old? He has finally agreed to resign. He was facing impeachment. The military was rattling its swords. They had put him under house arrest. And so Mugabe has finally stepped down. In a move that is slightly less callous than what they did last week at the Department of Homeland Security, when they gave very limited notice to 2,500 Nicaraguans that they got to pack their bags and get out of the United States. Well, the Trump administration is being a little more gentle. With 59,000 Haitians who were allowed into the country since the earthquake in 2010 devastated the Haitian half of the island of Hispaniola. They've given these 59,000 people, who are currently covered by the temporary protected status, until July 2019 to leave the United States or face deportation. Now we get to the latest coverage of gropers and other accused sexual predators. Yesterday, shortly after the Washington Post reported that eight women had accused Charlie Rose of inappropriate sexual behavior in the form of advances, parading around nude, apparently grabbing thighs, he was sacked by PBS, by CBS, and by Bloomberg. And I'm no fan of Charlie Rose. He's an establishment gatekeeper who's given a puffed up sense of importance. They gave him a slot on 60 Minutes where he'd do these fawning interviews. And I never thought that he ever crossed a line into being challenging, really forcing people to answer tough questions. He's kind of a, you know, a more cerebral Larry King. But this guy gets no chance to face his accusers. There is no due process. He has no rights to appeal the decisions that have been made by his employers. And since CBS is one of the companies that fired him, I'll share with you that I worked for CBS Radio for many years. I guess it was about eight. And I had a contract. And the contract, when they gave it to me, had a morals clause saying that, you know, if you embarrass us, we can fire you. And I said, wait a minute. I will only agree to that if I am convicted of a crime. And I successfully negotiated that amendment to my contract. Now, I never did get in any trouble with a girl or a guy or anybody else. And the issue never came into play. But I was aware that a single accusation that brought bad publicity to the radio station could lead them to fire me if I had agreed to the original language. So, as you know, I'm struggling with this. Our next report is from The Young Turks, the online media outlet run by Cenk Uygur. I know Cenk a little bit. I've rubbed elbows with him. I think he's a nice guy. I don't pay a lot of attention to The Young Turks, so I'm not familiar with one of their reporters, Jordan Cheriton, who was fired by The Young Turks last Friday after a single accusation published by Chicago activist Christian Chiokolis on the Huffington Post. And I have no position on whether Jordan Cheriton is guilty of a sexual assault that he says was a consensual sexual encounter, and that the incident is being portrayed in gossip as something else. He's posted two statements to Medium. He has welcomed an investigation by The Young Turks. And what if he is innocent? What if this is a false accusation motivated by somebody who has it in for Jordan Cheriton? Will he ever be able to work in media again? What is the penalty? And when we get into a he said, she said case, whether it was consensual or not, what level of proof is required to sustain the accusation? These are really troubling problems. And now John Conyers is fighting back. He's the 88-year-old congressman from Michigan. He's been in the House of Representatives since 1965. That's 52 years. And I've had some fun encounters with John Conyers. I think he's a bright guy. He's very progressive. He's a little bit long in the tooth. And apparently a reporter showed up at his door from the Associated Press, and he was a little confused about what investigation was being discussed, and he denied knowing anything about it. Apparently there are two issues. But he expressly and vehemently denies sexual harassment allegations. He wants the Ethics Committee to take a look at this. And he is being accused of engineering a settlement to a wrongful dismissal complaint in 2015 with a former employee who alleged she was fired because she would not, quote, succumb to his sexual advances. Now, in 2015, he still would have been 84 or something like that, 85. I guess, you know, with Viagra, 85-year-olds can be as frisky as anybody else. But I just, again, don't know how people can properly defend themselves from these kinds of innuendo and accusation. Here in San Francisco, a trial is about to go to the jury in the case that led to the death of Kate Steinle, a case that has been sensationalized, starting with Trump's use of it to demonize what he calls illegal immigrants, because the undocumented man accused of this crime tried to enter the United States and was deported multiple times. And in this case, we are seeing that the prosecutor has upped the ante. In the final stages, in the final arguments, the prosecutor, whose name is Diana Garcia, has demanded that the jury return a verdict of first-degree murder. Now, all through the trial, the discussion was a second-degree murder trial charge, which requires a finding of intent to kill or conscious disregard for human life. First-degree murder requires a finding of premeditation. And so far, there's been no evidence I've seen introduced here that would support that. The suspect, who is 45-year-old Jose Inez Garcia Zarate, said that he found the gun under a bench on the pier, picked it up, it went off. We know that the single bullet that was fired ricocheted and then hit and killed Kate Steinle. And the defense argues that this is a tragic accident that should never be prosecuted as murder. And I think that the overreach by the prosecutor is going to lead to a verdict more friendly to Garcia Zarate. Now, this was also linked to Trump's efforts to punish San Francisco and other localities for sanctuary city policies. Yesterday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco finalized its ruling and said that Trump acted unconstitutionally when he threatened to strip billions of dollars in federal funding from sanctuary cities and counties. Judge William Orrick III, he finalized his ruling saying Trump had committed multiple constitutional violations. The president has called his February order a weapon to use against jurisdictions that disagree with his preferred policies of immigration enforcement. He said Attorney General Sessions was not credible in his claims that Trump was actually targeting only a limited number of grants that Congress had expressly tied to compliance with a single immigration law. The president does not have the power to place conditions on federal funds that Congress has not already imposed, Orrick wrote. He also said neither the president nor Congress can threaten to withhold funding in a way that compels local governments to adopt certain policies. But the federal government can reward people, entities, jurisdictions that do not have sanctuary policies. And yesterday, Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions III, passed out $98 million in free money from the federal government, grants for law enforcement agencies that are friendly to cooperation with the feds, particularly on immigration issues. So, the standard is, you can bribe and reward, but you cannot punish. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's available free every day, and you can find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you.